Hello and welcome to Pale Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network where we reflect on Wildbo's most dashing work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebel.
And we are back to talk about Dash to Pieces 11.13 and 11.Z. But before then, a quick reminder, we're in the countdown to our live stream. All packed up to All Paled Up Beyond the Pale. So we thought we'd tell you about another segment that's going to be in it.
So this week's segment is the Pale Game Jam, which is another sequel segment. We did a packed game jam. Wasn't a great success.
It's the segment that we did from like midnight to 4 a.m.
So. No. It didn't start till 2. I don't think it was like,
oh God.
It was like 2 till 6.
Yeah, it was the twilight hours segment for sure. And it will be again. And that's why we love it, because it's a segment where we kind of lose the plot a little bit, which I think people find fun. I don't know, the kind of sickos that you are.
I mean, the embarrassing thing about it is that this is essentially both of our jobs, and we did so terribly.
But in fairness, it was from like 2 a.m. till 6 a.m., so what are you going to do?
And after we were sober.
Which is how I work every day. Anyway, it's going to be very, very fun. There'll be a... last time we did these like tarot card mix-up things where if people donated, they could basically pick punishments for us to do while we were doing the game jam, and those will be making a return. They were absolutely delightful. So
yeah,
look forward to that when we do All Packed Up to All Paled Up Beyond the Pale.
Yeah.
But let's get into Dash to Pieces 11.13, which is from Lucy's perspective. Wait, no, Avery's. Wait, no, Verona's. Well, not in that order, but. It's from the perspective of all three Kenneteers.
I love how Wildbo does these like all chapters, but doesn't
let you know
at all. Like, I'm just getting halfway through and I'm like, man, this chapter's moving at a weird pace. And then suddenly just like halfway through it cuts to Verona, I'm like, fuck, again.
Got me again. Yeah. We start with Lucy though. Lucy is going over her list of curses, trying to decide which ones she is morally okay with using.
Yeah, there's a really fun, like, extra materials vibe to a lot of this. Like, just the part, I'm mostly thinking of the part, you know, where she's literally reading from the book on, like, what some of these curses are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's very fun. Having said that, you know, by even choosing to play this game, and I think this is an interesting theme to carry through this and the next chapter, by even choosing to play the game, Lucy's kind of lost a bit, like, morally, right? Because she effectively has to decide which curses she's okay with using. And I feel like even having that question means that she's lost slightly. I mean, she obviously picks the best possible option here as her curse to use, but I don't know. It feels just kind of an exact description of why practitionering is so insidious, because any kind of power has to have some pretty horrible downsides.
Yeah. I don't know. I both do and don't agree with what you just said. Like, I definitely agree with the whole slippery slope sort of argument. Like, but then also I don't like the idea of like throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Like, because cursing can be bad and maybe even is mostly bad, that doesn't mean that the good parts aren't worth salvaging. So yeah, like, I don't know. I don't like the idea of just writing something off as bad because it has the potential to be bad. It's more like about figuring out how to do it right, which is something I trust Lucy with. But I mean, yeah, God, I see what you're saying. Like, if you want like groups of people to do this, it's so fucking easy to make. I mean, cursing is literally very toxic behavior. So it's like, God, I don't know where I land on this one. I don't want to write it off, but also that certainly feels like the safe option.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think she's picked the best option from the ones that we saw, the least like horrible. But it's hard for us to kind of know what the impact of this would be, especially when considering, you know, it's written by curse practitioners. Because we see an example of what happens with a curse, a much weaker curse that Lucy has done in this very chapter, right, when she bumps into Paul. Yeah. And it feels pretty fucked up. And that wasn't even like a curse that had a ritual to it. Like, that was clearly...
Well, that was an accident.
Yeah, essentially. Right? Like, yeah. Less power. And it was effectively, well, there were two parts to it, but one of the parts was just kind of, oh, you're a coward. And that was the curse that she stuck him with. And that seemed to have serious impacts. Like, even something that feels so innocuous. I don't know.
Well, I feel like it ties into the concept of, like, Lucy's anger. Like, because the, like, especially the curse of Paul, that was her lashing out. And that was, like, her anger being used in a bad way that she didn't agree with later. And so it's like the curse is the same thing. Like, cursing isn't the problem. It's, like, how you use it. Like, long-term, big scale, I don't know how you fix cursing so people only have to use it in the good way. Like, that's, which is why I maybe would have to just agree with you to, like, get rid of the whole practice. But I feel like the saving grace for curses for me, like, morally speaking, is that idea of, like, there's an inherent fairness in how they can be bounced back. Like, if you had a curse practitioner who built themselves up in this way, like it reminds me of all the stuff that was happening, like, you know, with the Sable in Edith's trial, where it was like, oh, you get all the power of the Sable behind you, and if you fuck it up, then it will bounce back on you.
Yeah.
Like there's a certain fairness to that, like it, taking on this responsibility or this risk for the power. And I feel like that would be the path forward I could see for cursing, is like this idea that you are doing stuff like this Sisyphean stone to limit someone and kind of like, you know, it's essentially down. Handcuffing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, with the idea being that that power will be returned back to you if it was used in bad form.
And I guess that's why that's something that's good about these, is inherent in any of these types of things, there is the potential for it to be, you know, bounced back, or even, we'll see this next chapter, it's pretty easy for Marcy to hand off the stone to an idiot. Like,
yeah,
it's inherent. Okay. I mean, obviously that's kind of a flaw too, that
yeah,
it is so exploitable in that way to just be like, here, oh, instead I'll just give it to this person who doesn't really know any better, and I'll fuck them over instead.
Yeah, I'm certainly picturing in my head something much closer to what was going on with the Sable, where it's this idea of like, the bounce back wouldn't just be dependent on them being able to trick you or anything, but it would more be how you used it and whether you did it right.
Yeah, whether, like, your actions were justified.
Yeah. So like, if we put aside the bullshit Marcy is currently pulling, which she can't, but let's pretend we can, like, they are sort of intentionally messing with her, but their motives are good. So it's kind of like that's the sort of thing where it should, like, that's the judgment sort of thing I'd want to see, is like, the curse gets bounced back on you if you rush into it, or if you, you know, go after someone you shouldn't, or that sort of thing. That's almost impossible to set up, because someone like Marcy will pull shit like she's about to do, and, like, you know, they're about to get hurt for the stuff they're doing because they're going after the wrong person.
God, we'll get to that soon enough, I suppose. The other fun part of the start of this chapter to me is even the characters are confused by the crossover between these terms in the book sometimes. Like, they're arguing about, like, what's the difference between ruin and all this stuff, and I'm like, oh, so relatable.
Yeah, the like, semantic puzzle solving is very fun, where they're like, well, I guess Discord is this, so maybe ruin is, like, this? Like, I certainly don't feel like I have a grasp on it, having read that part of the chapter twice. I'd have to go look it up again to feel confident knowing which one I'm going for. Especially because it's like, often the end result of a lot of these things can be essentially the same. It's more about the exact flavor of how someone would break their leg or something. It's very, it really helps it feel like an entire field. Like, that's what I continue to love about every flavor of practice in this story, is that it feels like its own entire magic system.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, each of these kind of parts or areas of magic of the practice are all so, they can go so deep. And I think that's great.
Yeah. Like, you could have like a normal novel sized story on a curse practitioner, on like, you know, an augur like Nicolette. Well, there's so many flavors of augury. You could have a whole series on different augurs. Like, there's so many individual systems in this one story that could carry entire stories of normal size if they wanted to. It's crazy.
Yeah. So yeah, Lucy takes some of Avery's favorite things, her rope and her pet possum, and then goes off for a walk to collect stuff for her cursing. And while out, she bumps into Paul.
Is this the first time we've seen Lucy take the black rope?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I feel like it's leaning into her new role a bit.
Her role is Avery.
back to Paul, because that's the
meat of this section for sure.
I love how the Paul stuff is like worked up to, though, because like Lucy, essentially, we know she's heading out to try and make herself cry. And she starts on this like what feels like a we failed you tour to try to make herself sad. Like she's going to all the like Hungry Choir's victims places. Mm-hmm. And you start to like be like, oh, you know, is this going to make her cry? And then you see Paul and it just hit me like a train. I was like, oh, no, she's going way harder than just the Hungry Choir victims.
Yeah, what a good moment. What a wonderful, wonderful moment this is. And it's like a really kind of quietly sad scene. Like Lucy encounters him and ends up forgiving him, which is a very interesting act of growth for her. But like also the fact that it ties into curses, it's like such a perfect reintroduction and such a great way for Lucy to kind of grapple with the concept of curses and what it means and the moral responsibility and use of her power. It's just all this cool, it's very cool stuff.
Yeah, well, because like I think we brought it up last week, the idea that like as soon as Lucy and cursing came up, we were like, that didn't go so well with Paul. Like,
yeah,
she hasn't thought about that in a while. Like, how's that going to tie in? And I completely underestimated how literally
it would tie in.
Yeah, Lucy would tie it in as well. Like, she goes out and seeks this. She basically admits it to herself later. Like, she was looking to run into Paul. Yeah, God, there's so much to talk about here. Like, I feel like she taps into this aspect of forgiveness that, like, anyone who listened to We've Got Ward has probably heard talked about to death. Like, Matt Scott used to bring it up all the time, this idea that, like, she's not forgiving Paul for Paul's sake, because he hasn't really gotten any better. It's, like, it's so much more for her. Like, she's the one moving on, not, like, Paul got better. She's getting to a place where she can leave it behind.
Yeah, totally. And it's interesting, like, it's her, she's having this conversation with Paul and she's kind of like accepting that she can't necessarily make him better or make that situation make sense completely, right? And it's almost like that's what she's letting go. She's letting go of this like niggling doubt in her head that is weighing her down, in the sense of like, you know, this is one of the things she sees as like a big impact in her life. And she's letting go of the fact that she can always make things right or make things just and fair. God, it just is great. It's such a great moment.
The moment where the tears actually start flowing for her, I'm jumping ahead a bit. But like the moment where she finally actually starts crying, the thing that really sets her off is the thought, not that Paul won't be her stepdad anymore, but the fact that even if he had been, like if he came back, whatever, he probably wouldn't have been a good one anyway. Like it's her, it's almost the moment where she sort of realizes that it was always going to be like this. There wasn't a fix. Like if it hadn't gone down between him and her mom, he just wouldn't have been that good anyway. And like it's that realization that just kind of breaks her. And then she sprinkles on top some thoughts about how John and Guillaume are both about to die, which, you know, probably doesn't help. As the other like sort of father figures in her life. It's
powerful stuff.
Yeah, this segment is so strong. And like the stuff with the curse as well, because it ties into what we were talking about last week with her and Dr. Mona. Like, the curse is that embodiment of like how she just used to lash out with her anger, and she comes in much more measured this time. And I feel like doing everything Dr. Mona was talking about, she sort of realizes that.
Yeah.
For the most part, this curse isn't actually like achieving anything. It's just hurting Paul, and that's hurting her.
Yeah. It's just kind of causing pain in the world, right? It's not for any purpose, right? Which is kind of what Dr. Mona was talking about. It's why are you getting into this argument? Why are you fighting this battle?
Exactly. And so it's like she lets it go at that point where Paul is like, I'm going to try and make things right with your mom. And he's still missing the point. Like, the thing here is, like, Lucy's like, he doesn't get total forgiveness. He still doesn't, hasn't really changed. He doesn't see fully what he did wrong. But the fact that, she sort of got him at this point now where he's going to try to make it up in some way, the financial one at least, is just like, this curse isn't achieving anything at this point, but yeah, just causing pain. So, like, for my sake, more than yours, I need to just, like, be done with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So good. It ties in, God, so much of everything. Like, what a fantastic storytelling moment.
Yeah.
Also, shout out to Brad, Paul's piece of shit racist brother, because not only... like, is he a piece of shit to, like, Lucy and just the world? He also constantly interrupts Paul to call him a coward. And I just love, like, the lack of self-awareness that it's like, hey, fuck you. You know, everything you said about my brother being a coward made him lose his job. And then when Paul starts talking, he's like, hey, fuck you, shut up, coward. Like, he just...
Yeah.
What an idiot. Like, he has no idea how much this curse and the spirits are fucking puppeteering him.
Just a stooge in every sense of the word, huh?
Like, just that's his role in the world. He doesn't actually put anything out. He doesn't realize everything he's saying is just coming from somewhere else. Like,
Lucy departs from this scene, and Snowdrop comes back with a smooth rock and some even smoother words.
Yeah, thank God Snowdrop's still here, and Snowdrop's still Snowdrop.
Yes, Snowdrop is a absolute delight in this story, huh? She comes in and it's a very cute moment, aside from, or maybe because of, all of this talk of butthole licking, which is just ridiculous and classic Snowdrop.
The butthole licking is such a good, like, the term icebreaker is jumping to my mind, but that's not what it is, because it's not break it, but, you know, it's like...
Some goofiness to lighten the tone, you know?
Yeah, but it's just that perfect flavor of ridiculous where, like, it lets someone like Lucy just escape the bad headspace she's in, right?
Yeah.
Because it catches you so off guard. You're just like, the fuck are you talking about? And then the cherry on top is just how that at the end, Sarah's going on, she's like, oh, yeah. Oh, well, she basically says, I tell Avery about this all the time because she fucking hates it hearing about it. Which is so good.
So, yeah, anywho, we then switch over to Verona's perspective. She is preparing a potion to make herself a little bit less human.
Oh, yep, dreams really do come true, Verona. Yep. You got there in the end.
Congrats.
Approval.
Yay, Verona. but she's like, it's interesting because it's not, I mean, maybe I'm just buying into Verona's propaganda here, but it doesn't feel like she's trying to escape her humanity for the sake of escaping her humanity.
No.
Her motivation that she brings up is, I mean, it's still a little bit toxic in that she has this vibe of like feeling like she's being useless for the past few chapters and needs to kind of make up for all the work that Avery and Lucy have been putting in, you know, while she was away and since then and all that stuff. And I guess it kind of is leading her to really like dive in with both feet, I suppose. Which is a little bit worrying, but could be worse, I guess.
I'm sure this is one of those situations where you get to pull the, like, it's both card a bit.
Mm.
I definitely agree that, yeah, like, there's this really unfortunate mind space she's in right now where she's like, oh, I got to take that time off and, you know, now I need to support these guys to make up for that. And it's just like, Verona, you essentially had a mental breakdown because your father finally, like essentially broke you. Like, it hurts me to see her being like, oh, I got to have this vacation and these two are left struggling. Because it's not wrong, but it's such an unfair read on, like, where she was those 2 weeks. Like, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. It's rough for Verona. I feel like she's just... I mean, I don't know. I think her headspace has been steadily improving over the course of the story. So this is just a transitional phase to her being perfectly mentally healthy, hopefully.
Well, I think like that's like the tough thing about reading Verona chapters since she got back is that she got this time and she actually managed to sort through a lot of her issues. And since coming back, it's been a mixture of a lot of these fixes are only temporary, which is a bummer. But yeah, then the other half of it that we're talking about now is this idea that she has to feel guilty about having had that time to get her shit together. because it did kind of come at the cost of Lucy and Avery getting any chance to do something similar for themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that comes back to this thing Pale's talked about so much, which is like the reason people can't help each other so much is because they're too busy drowning in their own bullshit. And now we're also talking about how when somebody like Verona can get their head above water for a bit, they then have to feel guilty that everyone else is still drowning. Like, it sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
On the other side of the coin, though, like the imagery of Verona in her, like,
as a fucking Frankenstein, yeah.
Yeah, her DIY mad scientist. I'm so glad she just straight up called it out as mad scientist vibes.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about this, again, just in this world, like, Verona just has fucking beakers and brass pipes with steam coming out of it. And it's just, I hate when you see that in my movies and TV shows where, like, it's like, oh, this person's a scientist and they've just got, like, beakers of stupid colored chemicals. And it's like, that's not what a scientist is. Except, like...
Except a mad scientist. Yeah.
Well, she's doing alchemy, like, which is actually where it is relevant. Like, it's, again, it's the other verse pulling a stupid trope that doesn't make sense and making it make sense. And I just love it.
Yeah, it is delightful.
But yeah, the idea that I'm fully on board with Verona and her cursed brass pipe steampunk bullshit is just amazing.
Yeah, it is good.
Verona also has an interesting interaction with Avery here that we should talk about. It's right at the start of the section where basically Verona calls Snowdrop like Avery's, and they sort of have to clarify that Avery doesn't own Snowdrop. And it's pretty clear Verona just wants to sort of really establish that Snowdrop is, like, primarily bonded with Avery.
Mm.
And this especially stood out to me because there's a super similar interaction in the first couple of sentences of 11.11. So it's like the last two Verona segments of this story have both had this in the first, like, five sentences.
Mm.
Which definitely makes me feel like it's a thing. I don't know what it is, though. It's like, is this Verona really establishing that Avery has her thing and Lucy has her implements so she gets to have the domain? They've already said she gets that. So, like, I don't know. I wonder if this is something about Verona feeling lonely. I don't know. I have no idea where this is going, but it stands out to me as something that's going somewhere.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because Avery is clearly trying to, like, reaffirm that Snowdrop isn't just her familiar, but, like, a part of their team. Which I think is good, but, you know, Avery was the one who did the ritual with Snowdrop, so there's obviously going to be always a stronger connection between them, right?
Yeah, to be fair, I think Avery's primary concern is making sure that it doesn't sound like she owns
Snowdrop. Snowdrop, yes.
Which is, like, absolutely a good clarification for Avery to continue making.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, Verona's right in the point that she's actually trying to make, which is Snowdrop is primarily bonded to Avery. She might be part of the team, but, like, her and Avery are much more tightly coupled than Snowdrop and the other two, which, like, you know, I mean, you could say the same thing about Verona and Lucy, and, like, with Avery and Snowdrop as the third and fourth wheel. So, like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know why Verona keeps bringing this up. It just feels like Verona keeps wanting to clarify that Snowdrop is closer to Avery than her and Lucy, and I don't know why she keeps feeling like this is a point she has to make.
Yeah. I would say that it's probably just her being a bit of a, like, a rules lawyer, or, like, she's very into the practice, and so she wants to make sure, even though she probably conceptually understands that Snowdrop isn't owned by Avery, she knows that they've done the ritual and she hasn't done the ritual, so there's probably a bit of that.
Yeah, maybe it's her looking out for Avery. Like, she's trying to help Avery acknowledge that Avery has a very strong permanent relationship in her life that isn't going anywhere.
Yeah,
because God knows Avery will let herself forget that if she can.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna choose to go with that read for now because it's kind of heartwarming in the clumsy way Verona's going about it.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Maybe it is nice and heartwarming. anyway, so Verona and Lucy are following Liz, and they keep kind of doing this very funny game of cat and mouse where both participants think that they're the cat, which I think is fun. It's just a very fun sequence.
Yeah, it's a really nice twist on the like chasing a shapeshifter trope.
Yeah.
Because they have an eye in the sky, quite literally, I think.
Yeah.
Telling them exactly who she's shapeshifting into, so they're never more than half a step behind.
Yeah, it's almost like an inversion of the scene we got with Bridge. That was what his name was, right? Because this time they have Nicolette just being like, nope, they're trying to do this, cut them off. Nope, now they're trying this, cut them off. It's like, I kind of feel bad for Liz because she's trying to pull all her tricks out of the bag and just nothing works. It must be so frustrating.
Yeah. Although, like, on the other hand, it simultaneously just shows how formidable she actually is. Like, I can see how this is the person who wiped out two crews of witch hunters now. Because, like, they learn she's essentially able to replicate their tools and abilities.
Yeah, which is pretty wild.
Like, yeah, like more so than the Marisica stuff, which is going to end up being a nightmare for them. This is the conflict where it actually kind of mattered that they didn't bring their best stuff with them. Because it gave Liz less tools to work with. Like again, just another example. Liz could be a really interesting villain for a whole story because she's someone who literally reflects what you bring back at you. Like that's really cool. And like it's almost a shame that we only get to see it for this one chapter.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a bummer that we don't get to see Liz doing this for our practitioner protagonists instead of against them, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, I think Verona has that thought too. She's like, God, this is so cool. Why did she have to be against us?
Yes.
I mean, I'm still curious. Like, I hope we still get the chance to interview Liz. I suppose she'll come up in this trial,
probably. Well, she almost certainly will after they fail to pin anything on Marisica. Or in air quotes, Marisica.
Yeah. but yeah, because I just like, I'm still so interested to see. I think Liz has this one moment where she sort of says, what the hell, like, you guys are the good practitioners and this is how you're treating me, which felt like a very unfair claim considering all the shit she's pulled. But like, I'm curious to get into Liz's head and see why she's doing what she's doing.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Sig is caught, Liz is on the ropes, and Marisica makes her appearance, except it's not Marisica. It's somebody pretending to be Marisica, a plan that both the Kenneteers and Marisica came up with.
Hold on to this idea. We'll come back to it later.
it is a kind of clever plan, pretending to be Marisica to try and kind of fish for some ammo, but it unfortunately fails.
To jump quickly back to the throwaway mention you had of Sig getting caught, just a quick shout out to Verona's anti-smoke element that she made with alchemy. It gets its fun little moment as it kind of blocks Sig from leaving. Again, another interview I'm very excited for.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Who knows what it will even look like, but I'm excited to see it.
It'd have to be another dream thing, like how they talk to Monty, right? Like they're going to have to share dream. Although I don't think Sig sleeps, so do they Alcazar him or something? I don't know how it works, but they'll have to do something magical like that to be able to talk to him.
Yeah, we'll have to see. Marisica turns out to be Avery, and I really thought this was a clever plan, except Liz is 100% onto them, presumably because she's familiar enough with fake Marisicas that she can see through one.
I'm not gonna lie, I saw through this the second Marisica, I think the second like Avery opened her mouth as Marisica, I was like, that's not Marisica. And if I didn't see through the other one of these at all. So like the fact that I saw through this in a second, I just think tells you it's just not as good.
Fair enough.
But credit to Wildbow, because I think doing this here just makes you feel like even more of a dumbass for not seeing it in the next chapter. Like it's so good. Like, yeah. I love everything about this fake Marisica reveal.
It is wonderful that both their plan and Marisica's plan revolves around a fake Marisica. I think we'll talk about in the next chapter how many parallels there are between what Marisica is doing and the Kenneteers, right? Because they're literally everywhere. But I think this is just a great one to lead us into that concept.
This is something I didn't notice until my second read, but yeah, just one of them impersonating Marisica, I was like, oh, for fuck's sake.
Like, yeah, it's Wabba's slapping you over the head with it.
Like, yeah, well, it's just rude.
It's pretty funny. But so yeah, we then jump back into Avery's head and we see kind of the continuation of this fight. Liz is throwing spells at the trio and the trio are kind of attempting to subdue her.
Yes, but I do want to say, before we jump back into that fight, Avery does, we do have a little bit of time with Avery back at the house on Half Street. And it's just really fun kind of getting to see her as the person just sitting, like, waiting in the background.
Mm.
Because you, we don't get much of it. I think it's because you can tell she's not really happy being in the back like that and just, like, waiting. And I love how she sort of codifies the practices they've been leaning into, because I don't think we quite got there last week, but it's all the things they naturally wanted to lean towards when they first awoke, but, like, got scared out of and decided not to pursue. And I just find, like, I think it's a bad plan to go up against Marisica with that stuff, and obviously it's not going to work, but there's, like, a really fun thematic idea behind not just trying to be the opposite of who you are, but going down the path that you didn't take for some reason.
Mm.
Like, I'm almost sad that they're not going to continue to be these alternate versions of themselves for another arc, because I'd love to continue to see. Like, it feels like the sort of thing that is really good about, like multiverse stories in, like, superhero things or sci-fi. Like, when you encounter alternate versions of the characters and you sort of learn how different things set them on different paths. Like, that's the same sort of thing that they're starting to explore here. And I almost feel like we're going to get the rug pulled out from under us because there's so much other shit to do. And I'm like, God damn it. Like, this is really cool.
Yeah, yeah. It is cool. It is a bit of a bummer that they can't, that we aren't going to see more of it. Yeah, I mean, the Kennedys feel like they're doing so well in this. Like, the fact that they've mixed it up is clearly working, right? They're really on Liz's tail, and it's like, oh shit, they could actually pull it out, and then, well, we'll see. But, you know, they end up essentially having no chance from the get-go in the next chapter.
Yeah, and I mean, like, that's, like, that's what's so great about this is I think, like, with the Eater thing, they felt so unprepared. They'd spent all this time waiting, and then it kind of went so well that they came into this one. And, like, we've spent probably the majority of this arc planning for this confrontation. Mm. Like, this has been the longest arc in the story now by a good, like, 20%. And most of it has been dedicated to leading up for this. And it's just, like, they've put so much effort in. They've done so much preparation. It feels like the victory should be so earned. And just the second Marisica shows up, you just immediately get the vibe of they're fucked. Like, they're just, like, they're so, this is nothing. They're, like, yeah, they put all this effort in and they've achieved nothing.
Yeah, it's, yeah, it is worrying, isn't it? But yeah, so Marisica shows up, throwing out words about how she's actually innocent and Miss and Rook are the dangerous ones. And yeah, the game is on. I think it's interesting, like, I mean, obviously we'll dive into this mostly next chapter, right? But she lumps in Miss and Rook. She says Miss and Rook are the dangerous ones, and this continues into the next chapter. But it's something that I didn't notice on my first read is, like, this means she knows Rook is working with Miss and the Kenneteers, which we didn't know that she knew, right? Like, this is new information to us that she's aware of this. Makes you wonder how long she has been aware of this.
Yeah, it's funny because this sort of conversation, I think it came up on our Discord when we first read 10.z, I think it was, like the one where, you know, we found out that Marisica was in it. And I was sort of like, oh, well, there goes all the secret plans about Miss or whatever. And, I think some other people sort of like, yeah, but, you know, she didn't mention Rook. And I was like, I just assumed that she, like, I bet you she knew Rook and Miss were working together well before the Kenneteers did. I agree. I don't think we knew that she knew this for sure, but it fits so neatly into just the vibe I get from Mariska, which is she's just been on top of this shit from day one.
Yeah, it definitely seems that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, let's get into the next chapter, Dash to Pieces 11.z, from Mariska's perspective. Mariska is playing around with words as the culprit starts to escape.
But she isn't. That's the thing. It's...
Well, I mean, yeah, it's good, isn't it? It's like rereading the second time is a very fun chapter because it's you just get to see all of these shenanigans and see how simple it is, and they're clearly, you can see the Kenneteers, you can feel them running the words over in their head, but the one part they're not questioning is the part where the trick lies.
And I mean, like, because I was the fucking same. Like, as I was reading this, I was studying the words, and I'm like, I can't see the loophole. Like, I don't, like, I fell for the exact trap. Wabo laid out the same trap for me that Barisica did, like, for the Kenneteers, right? Like, it's beautiful. And I mean, like, it must be so daunting to sit down and write, like, a fairy interlude, because I was so excited when this started. Like,
yes.
Holy shit, finally, a fairy interlude. Because they're talked up so much as these intricate puppeteers who are, like, you know, playing 12D chess. And, like, God, that must be intimidating to sit down and write.
Yeah, well, maybe I'm jumping ahead a bit here, but I think the thing that I found really interesting that I took from this is it's so delicate. The balance of the web that Marisica weaves is so delicate. And we see this a few times where somebody says something or does something and Marisica thinks, oh, you could totally fuck me over if you did these things and it would really, really fuck with my plans. It doesn't happen because Marisica is obviously talented at what she does enough to kind of manipulate the web. But you can see that there actually are quite simple ways to shut her down if you just stumble upon the right ways, which mainly is just by not allowing her to pull her shenanigans on you, e.g. being very goblin.
Well, the thing she talks about a lot in terms of the goblins in this chapter is the way they force themselves into the narrative and take center stage. Like, that's the thing that kind of fucks with these webs. Because, yeah, like, as you talked about, you know, fairy aren't fucking path to victory, like parahumans or anything. They're weaving a web and they're basically just constantly playing the odds and setting up contingencies as well. And that's something we see Marisica specifically do a lot. So you're right. It there's just this underlying sense of, like, she's constantly thinking of the ways people could break her shit, and she's just thinking about, like, why they're not going to or what she can do even if they do. Like, it's not about having the perfect plan. It's about playing the odds and having contingencies.
Yeah. But it's just interesting to me that, like, the line between everything going exactly according to plan and everything going horribly wrong is actually very, very thin for Marisica.
Yeah. I suppose that tracks with what we've heard about her being, like, a young fairy, kind of inexperienced with humans. Like, she's... Yeah. This is seemingly one of her first extended stays out of her court of birth. So she's learning a lot still.
Yeah.
I feel like just the idea of writing a fairy interlude must be so daunting. And I'm just surprised at how much it stacked up with my expectation of how, like, convoluted and sneaky and tricky a fairy would be.
Yeah.
Like, it's so impressive because I don't know. I've seen so many other media or whatever where, you know, you talk up, an ancient race of beings or whatever, and then when they show up, they just don't quite land. Like, like, the authors can talk them up, but then in practice, they just don't really work out to be
as intimidating as they should.
Yeah, and I think being inside Marisica's head, like, it showed a more flawed and human fairy than I might have expected, but still held up in those core ways. She still felt...
Yeah, definitely.
As, like, sneaky, intricate, manipulative as I, like, hoped.
Yeah. I just want to pull out one of my favorite lines from the start of this chapter, which is, "It's my understanding that by focusing on me, you're allowing the real culprits to escape." Which is just so fucking funny when you think about it. It's such a perfect line because, yeah, Marisica, the real culprit, is actually being allowed to escape right now.
Yeah, that's probably the one line that made me laugh the most on my second read.
It's so good.
Like, that's one of those ones where I was scouring it for, like, clues as to how it was a misdirect and just, like, absolutely losing, like, the forest for the trees.
It's not a misdirect. This fake Marisica is telling them point blank that they're focusing on the wrong person. And they're just like, what does this mean? Ooh.
Yeah,
like, it's so good.
The way Marisica, like, phrases it later with just, like, the way she just played them, she was like, I'm going to get them to focus on the, like, you know, minutiae of the words so that, they just lose the forest for the trees. And it works so well. And like it ties it so like it's so great having Liberty here. I feel like that's the only reason they have any hope. It's just yes. like Liberty just like there's this great moment where Liberty's sort of like, okay, I'm pretty sure she did it now.
Yeah.
Because like she says she's innocent. Like I wasn't involved in this, but like this is clearly bullshit. She did it, and like fucking she's got like some chicken air horn and shit. Like it's so
Liberty is so good. I mean, one of my favorite bits is Liberty says something and fake Mystica's like, oh, are you talking about me or all fair in general? Liberty's response is, are you an idiot? Who's the little idiot who doesn't understand? Like it's so fucking wonderful. And like it's like I'm sure we've all had this experience, right? Where Mystica is the you know, the one who's so clever and has the perfect argument to shut them down, but the person they're arguing with doesn't play by those rules. And it's so frustrating, and I love it so much.
Yeah, it's such a perfectly goblin counter to this fairy manipulation. Like,
yeah.
They're asking this really, like, you know, misdirective, manipulative question, and you just turn it on them by being the biggest child you can. So good.
It is very, very good.
So yeah, I found the quote I was talking about before. It's like Mariska is, well, fake Mariska, sort of going on. It's like, you know, the only reason you have to accost me is your own misconceptions over the situation. You're making a mistake. And Libby's just like, okay, now I really think that she did it.
Yeah.
And yeah, she's spot on, kind of. There's a lot of that. Like Lucy's first response to what Mariska says is she's like, what do you mean my understanding? And I was like, oh, Lucy, you almost got it.
Almost, almost. Didn't quite get there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, again, worth noting, like, this is an interlude from Mariska's perspective, but there's, like, because of the trick that is revealed later, it sits a little strange because there's, like, weird parts where she's referring to herself and that she's referring to like her wings and her face and all this stuff that just doesn't quite sit correctly until you realize what's going on. And it's like, again, just like Wabo setting it up so perfectly. I really love it. And it's such a simple trick and it makes such perfect sense with everything we know about Mariska and glamour and even how the Kenneteers have used glamour in the past. Like it's the most basic thing, but for some reason it just is so tricky.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is why I fell in love with Pact when we first started reading that in Deep Impact. It was because of these moments where we got to read a chapter the second time and just, like, you just get to hit your forehead with your palm over and over being like, fuck, it was right there. Like, this world's ability to trick you. And then when you reread it with the context, you're just like, I'm a fucking idiot. Like that's, I mean, I think I've said a bunch of times, like my favorite type of twist is one that makes me feel like an idiot for not seeing it.
Yeah.
And that's just what this whole chapter is. Like you just read it and all this weird bullshit with like, ah, yes, Mariska's wings did this and Mariska's voice does that. And then other times it's much more like possessive and you just don't quite notice it or give it the attention it deserves the first time. And then the second time you're like, ah.
Yeah,
good.
Very tricky,
and it fits into what the chapter's doing in a really cool way. It's actually a really interesting meta narrative device because essentially this is the chapter that teaches us that Mariska doesn't want to be who she is, and so it's so interesting that, like, I guess from a bit of a meta narrative perspective, there's confusion in the way the text is written about what is Mariska and what is fake Mariska. Like, the text is blurring the lines between the two because that's what Mariska is actually trying to do. Like, so of course it's reflected in the way she's thinking about things. She wants that person to take the role of Mariska away from her. Like, yeah, very cool meta-narrative device.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Now, here's one that I think isn't explained, where fake Mariska says, based on my understanding of the current situation, Rook and Miss would see every human in Kennet and every practitioner in the region eliminated. How could that not possibly be a lie?
It just has to be. I mean, it could not be a lie, but like I have to believe that Mariska set fake Mariska up with an intentionally skewed set of facts so that she was allowed to draw conclusions like that.
Yeah, I guess that based on my understanding gives a fair amount of leeway. Like Marisica could have just said, well, she couldn't have said this is what's going on. She could have said, I don't know, whatever.
Like, if she just said something like they're trying to undermine the Seal of Solomon in Kennet and remove practitioners from the equation.
Yeah.
And then like fake Marisica would have like knowingly been allowed to go from that to, oh, that must mean they want humans gone and all the practitioners eliminated, which is sort of a fair interpretation of removing the Seal of Solomon.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
So like I have to believe that it's the two of them pulling bullshit like that just because I will not accept that Rook and Miss are that evil.
Yeah, it sounds pretty ridiculous, doesn't it?
They obviously want some sort of societal overhaul.
Yeah.
But like, I'd like to think that especially Miss isn't willing to see all the innocents sacrificed to achieve it.
Yeah.
I can't reconcile that with the Miss that we know.
Yeah. So we jump back in time and we see Marisica's birth before she ends up meeting her small family.
This is so cool. Like, I love how from the very second she's born, like Marisica is already just looking around and she's pulling details from the environment. As soon as she meets her brother and then the other fairy, everything is about like these social interactions. Like they don't have a language yet. And so everything's based on like simple movements. Like I think I forget her name, Marwith or something.
Mm.
Like chops off a bit of her hair and eats it, and Marisica sort of like immediately reads that as like asserting dominance. Like there's this just this really cool xenofiction-y vibe to like something being born that is born to do social interactions and begins to establish its baseline of what those are as it experiences them. It's so cool.
It is a very cool segment, isn't it? The interactions between her and her family are very strange, but you know, like kind of compassionate in a very weird way.
Yeah, and I mean that's what's so crazy like about this setup is like they sort of dumped it. And obviously we learned that there was a mole later, so that kind of undermines it, but as it's happening to Marisica, and for the most part it's like she and her kin have been sort of essentially dumped in this environment without a language, and they form their own language, they form like their own social hierarchy, and you know, like fairy to me are all about, like fairy represent the sort of artificial stories and society that we create for and tell ourselves about, and so the idea that these ones that are born into this court actually kind of start as a blank slate and literally like exhibit that meaning by building their own mini society is so cool. And then it's heartbreaking because they essentially build like relatively a pretty healthy one. Like, you know, there's infighting and stuff, but like nobody dies. Like there's no big betrayals. They sort of go out, they're exploring the world. Like there's this innocence to them. They build something kind of nice. And then it's like the second larger society gets involved, it all just gets torn apart and broken, and it fucking sucks.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a rough world that they're born into, huh?
Yeah, and like that's what makes that moment where Marisica basically reveals that the reason she is always essentially naked is actually like a callback to her mourning the beauty of the world that she was actually born into before she discovered the rest of it.
Mm.
Like it, because you know, I think my read on her being naked all the time was just so it would upset people like Avery.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, of course it wasn't that simple. Like, it's actually this heartbreaking callback to the world that she could have had but didn't get to have because fairy society came in and took it away from her and her siblings.
Yeah, like, as well as it just feels like an extension of her desire to kind of reject the norms of the society that she exists in, right?
Yeah.
You know, we see a lot of, like, fineries, I guess you would call them. So what could be the antithesis of that more than refusing to wear clothes?
Yeah, exactly. Like that's a really good point. Like if fairy are society and the lies and the stories we tell ourselves of what society is, then like clothes are such a core part of that. Shirking them kind of was a big clue as to how she felt about all of it.
Yeah.
I mean, the comparison we have to bring up in this is just like to Toad Swallow in 10.e. Like I'm sure a lot of other people have sort of talked about this as well, but it's just like this really sort of sells some of Toad Swallow's stuff about thinking of goblins as the Eighth Court, because Marissica and stuff, they're essentially brought into that same violence bullshit that Toad Swallow was born into. It's just a bit more removed and convoluted and ridiculous because it's fairy, but it's like, you know, by the end of this, it's essentially turned into that same bullshit combat trial shit that Toad Swallow was born into, just over years instead of minutes.
Mm. Yeah. I guess we're going to be talking about Marissica and the horror of the system she was born into over the rest of this chapter, I suppose. So we should keep moving. The fairy family is faced with a test in the Fey Parade, and it continues to be horrible.
Yeah, because if I'm sticking to this interpretation of fairy representing constructed society, like the parade so perfectly captures the like artificial horribleness of what the fairy let their society be. Like it's slaves carrying this platform that has all this stupid shit on it. There's like a literal dance where you get punished for not understanding how it works, even though you weren't taught it. Like what a great metaphor for how society can look from the outside. It's such a perfect introduction from this tranquil, nice kind of society that these young budding fairy built for themselves, and then we just immediately see this chaotic, awful, like cruel society that the main fairy have built that has survived and they're now going to be forced into.
Mm. They're literally going to be disfigured to fit within this box, right? Like very literally molded.
Yeah, some more than others.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's a bit of a meme in the Wahabo community of like, oh, we have a villain who we hate until we get their interlude and then we love them or whatever. And I don't think that's what happens here. Like, I don't like Marissica, but clearly what she is experiencing and the thing that she decides to do as a result is a slightly more selfish version of what our protagonists want to do and what the characters we respect want to do, right? Which is break the confines of this system and not have labels define so strictly the role that these characters need to play in this kind of societies. And yes, it's Marissica's doing it for herself, right? And she doesn't seem to be wanting to change the system, but more escape it by herself, which is obviously a more selfish interpretation, but it's not one that we can necessarily hold against her. Like, I don't know. Yes, she's breaking some eggs to make the omelet, and that's obviously a problem, but she's doing something pretty defensible and almost noble, right?
Yeah, her core motivation is extremely sympathetic. To your sort of first point, like I feel like that the way that stuff gets memed in the Wahabo community about making us love the villains kind of undersells what Wahabo's actually doing, which is just painting them as people. Like that, and that's what happens with Marissica here. It doesn't make you think, oh, she's secretly a good person. What it does is paints a picture of how somebody ended up where she is.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you not think she's good, but like sympathize with her. And yeah, as you said, like I'm reminded of Toad Swallow, obviously, but like also Miss, like the Oni, but like so much of this story has just been people and others who are getting put in boxes, and they're like, I don't want to be in this box.
Mm.
And there's almost this sense of this is just different people's ways of trying to get out of theirs. I think what separates Marissica to me from someone like, to take Toad Swallow as an example, or Miss.
Mm.
Toad Swallow and Miss are building something to escape the system. They're trying to build something better.
Yeah.
Mariska's tearing shit down so she can escape. Like, you talked about the selfish angle, but I think the part that irks me more is just she's doing it at the cost of other things. She's tearing everything else down for everyone else so she can escape. Whereas, like, Toad Swallow has worked to try and be in a position to build something so that he and other people can escape and do something better. And, like, that's going to be the core difference for me as to why I can back Toad Swallow but not Mariska.
Yeah. It is. Mariska's not trying to change this system. She just wants to escape it for herself, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but I could excuse that if she wasn't tearing
if she wasn't
down,
yes, 100%. Like, if she wasn't making damaging other people to do it, right?
Yeah.
Should we note her brother, Brisbane is his name, Australian city Brisbane. He's turned into a tongue because he said one too many words, which is a great marker of just how harsh and fucked up Fae society can be, I suppose.
Well, and just how fake it is, because something Mariska notes in her internal monologue a lot is that her brother is better at this stuff than she is. Like, he's the one that leads them into the dance. He's the first one to pick up on stuff. She's constantly telling us in the text, he is better at this than me.
Mm.
And so then, he's the first one to get killed, and, like, Mariska's the one who ends up, like, if you're sort of taking what fairy society says it is and what it's going to be, that doesn't hold up, because on top of being torturous and gross, like, morally and all that, they're not even picking the best candidates. Like this whole system is completely fucked. Because, not only is it just bad, but
it's not even
doing
work.
What it claims to do. It doesn't achieve anything but, doing torture and fucking around with people. Like, that's the only part of it that actually holds up.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good point. This system not only is fucked up, but also doesn't do what it wants to do. Like, it's just a big waste.
Yeah, exactly. The moment in this chapter that absolutely gutted me, because Mariska watches her brother, and she keeps thinking, this is the one person in the world I can trust. She watches him get, torturously killed, and she has to keep the smile on her face.
Yeah.
And there's just that moment where, the tongue is laying there after being dropped and stepped on by other people. And she just sort of thinks her brother, the smile she'd worn up into the stage didn't falter, even as a significant part of her went very quiet inside her breast. Fuck, that line got me. Like, that's just, it just highlights how bullshit everything about the Fae is. Like, she just is smiling through. Dying inside.
So we see Mariska rise from succeed at her test, and she earns her way to the human world and her chance at escape.
Yes, and I love the time skip that goes on here, this way that we very quickly cut from the results of a series of tests, and the thing that really stands out to you as you're going is each one's getting significantly longer, and that raises the stakes and the danger. You can totally see how this would be a little montage in a film of Mariska coming back wearing different clothes and being a bit bigger every time she saw the consort. Great. It's just sort of a great little moment to really sell how she's grown over a long period of time.
Yeah And it's fun to see, right? You're right, seeing how she's grown. But also kind of just I don't know, maybe you didn't have this picture, but we've heard so much about her being a young, inexperienced Fae from Gilliman stuff, right? But I almost get soft, Chosen One vibes from her in this. Like, her story could be the story of a protagonist, right? Mariska could be the protagonist of a story, and she is clearly the protagonist of her own story. And I think it's just kind of interesting to point out, she's clearly very, very good at what she does. And we haven't seen a lot of Mariska in action. In fact, seemingly intentionally, she's stayed out of conflicts a lot in the town, so that she doesn't have to reveal what she's like in action because she's fucking terrifying. Like, she's clearly very good at what she does.
Yeah, I definitely get, yeah, those protagonist-y chosen one-y vibes because, like, it's the dynamic that is set up here is that essentially none of the naturally born fairy of this court make it this far. And I think that makes sense because this the Darkfall court is the court of, like, change and subversion. So, of course, like, the last thing it wants is people born into it because they're not the ones who are going to change it. They're the ones who are born of what it is now. Mm. They want external people to come in and, like, flip it over.
Mm.
And, of course, the ironic thing being is that they've born this woman who's probably going to do more to fuck with their system than they could have hoped for. Mm. But, yeah, no, you're right. Like, this idea of, like, she beat this system, like, she rose through it the hard way, is just incredibly talented and gifted. It really sells that part where she fucking hates it. She wants to bring it down. Like, it, I love how those two thoughts connect. It's like, she's really good at this. She's the natural. She's the chosen one. And she wants to see it all burn.
Yeah.
She doesn't want it for herself.
Well, I mean, she's an agent of change, right? Well, exactly. She could be an agent of change, but instead she's an agent of escape, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, the obvious comparison to make here as well is to Verona, as somebody who, you know, had a lot of talent or whatever, but, like, just was spurned by the shitty situation she was brought up in and didn't want to be part of that society anymore. Like, there was a bit of a Verona vibe. Something that jumped out to me on my second read of this chapter was we get a bunch of comments from Marisica about how she doesn't want to be a fairy anymore.
Mm.
We don't get a single hint at what she's picturing any change might look like. And that could just be because it's something Wildbo's keeping up his sleeve or it was out of the scope of the chapter. But it reminded me so much of, like, what we used to yell at Verona for in the first two arcs of this story, which is, like, Verona would be that thing. She's like, I don't want to be a human anymore. I was like, okay, what changes do you picture yourself making?
Mm.
And she never had anything. And, like,
yeah, Verona, is this what you want your life to be instead? Because it's not great.
Oh, that was the vibe I started to get from Marisica on the second read. Is it's like, you know, Marisica, what do you want to not be fairy? Okay, and what does that look like? Not a fairy. Like, she doesn't exhibit any idea of knowing what she wants to be. She just knows she doesn't want to be what she is.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, That's going to be, like, that's going to be the big wrinkle for me. Like, she's tearing this whole system down. And if we find out that, like, in amongst all this, she doesn't fully know what she wants to be. She just knows she doesn't want to be what she is. Like, that's going to sit even worse with me. Like, fucking know what you're trying to do before you do this shit.
Mm. Yeah. Or at least have some clearer thoughts on, yeah, what you're actually trying to change.
Yeah. There's absolutely just room for that just wasn't something Wildbo brought up in this chapter, and she does have that image, but as long as we don't know that she does or doesn't, I'm just going to, like, yell at her the same way I did at Verona, because, like, that's a huge part of the justification to me for doing this stuff. I'm still not okay with all the shit that's gone down, but if you're going to try and defend yourself, you've got to at least know what you were trying to do. I mean, again, we're back at Dr. Mona and Lucy again. Like, you've got to know what you're trying to achieve for something good to come out of your actions.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know. Like, I guess the end state of how I feel about Mariska at the end of this is she has some really cool ideas, but she just decides to apply them in a selfish, villainous way instead of, you know, working with the Kenneteers, I guess. Like, could you see a version of this where she goes to Miss and the Kenneteers and says, hey, I fucking hate being a fairy, but I know if I try and change the Wild Hunt, whatever that is going to come after me. What can we, is there anything we can do to make Kennet a refuge for me? Like, I don't know, possibly, yeah. Right?
Yeah,
imagine if she wasn't trying to fuck up Kennet. It might have actually been able to help her.
Especially because, I guess in her defense, she had that moment where her brother died.
Yeah.
And she was like, there goes essentially the only person I can truly trust.
Yeah.
So she has kind of understandably valid trust
issues. Yeah.
But then on the other hand, like the thing another thing that kind of irks me about her whole plan is, like, what is more fairy than this convoluted kill a giant dog and set this whole place into chaos so I can stop being a fairy plan? Like, it's such a... She's unintentionally leaning into the trappings of the fairy so much to carry out this plan. And maybe that's an unfair criticism, but, like you're right. Like, she's going it alone. She's not cooperating. And, like, pale.txt would be cooperation is good. Mm. So, yeah, like, it's just frustrating.
Yeah. But yeah, so we jump back or forward, I guess, to the impromptu trial. The fight continues, and Avery pulls a battle transformation.
Well, she has a battle transformation pulled on her.
Yeah, true.
Probably more accurate.
Well, she says it, right?
No, I think it's Liberty who says it.
Wait,
does... Avery's response is like, "No, I don't want this."
Holy shit! Okay, maybe I misread that section. Anyway. Battle transformations happen, and they're wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. It's more proof that, like, Liberty was the right person to bring
this,
because this is the sort of chaos that would be very helpful if they had even a remote chance of winning, which they don't, but, like, this would be helping if they did. And it's also just proof that Liberty is just the best, and she is the fifth candidate, and I will not be taking further questions.
Yeah, definitely. She's great. It's a great moment. But yeah, so... The Marisica's trick is revealed. Marisica is distinct from her wings and her face, and she has just been hidden as a small autumn fae fairy this entire time. Sorry,
fairy with a Y.
Fairy, yes. She starts to get away before our hero Pekkasnot attacks.
My boy. This is a super fun reveal. Like, I guess we've already gone over this, but just... The way Marisica had them fucking chasing the nuances of the words, and the way Wildbo had us doing that, just because, yeah, like, it was such a great misdirect. I totally lost the forest for the trees, exactly like Marisica wanted. It's yeah, what a great reveal. Made me feel like an idiot. 10 out of 10. Would do it again. Probably will.
And then, of course, the beautiful moment where, just as it seems like Marisica is getting away with it, we almost get a moment where Pekkasnot and Cherry Pop save the day. And it would have been so good. Oh, my God. I understand why Wabo didn't want to commit to it. And he probably had the idea and thought, well, this would be great. I'll have to at least almost have it happen.
Yeah, no, I agree. It would be just a little too convenient if it actually
happened. If it actually worked, yeah.
But being teased with it is all that I needed, I think, because you're right. Like, just the vibe of those two being the ones who stop Marisica is just so fucking good. And, like, yeah, they seriously hamper her. Like, it's such a great case for why, like, this mass of goblins is such a great counter to a fairy, because she just can't keep track of all the stupid bullshit. Like, who would expect this? Like, beat up one-eyed baby goblin to sneeze on her when she's, like, you know, looking around the arena and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, these two idiots are doing what nobody could expect, because it's the stupidest shit.
Yeah. But Marisica is able to not get caught by, you know, doing what she wants to do, changing her identity, changing how she acts. A line that I really liked to sum this up said, as she's thinking about her changing who she is, that process started with learning to dumb it down when dealing with some of the dumbest creatures in Kennet. So instead of doing anything too tricksy, she just does a very simple, straightforward, to the point, blunt manipulation, and it works. And she's kind of casting off her need to be an elaborate fae. She's maybe falling into it a bit much by wanting to stick around and see how everything plays out, when I don't think she really needs to do that. But eventually she even decides to move on from this scene and let herself move on.
Yeah, because something we didn't call out, like the rock that Snowdrop got for Lucy, is explained as, like, oh yeah, when Cherry Pop needs to tire herself out, she just smashes rocks into shapes, which is just hilarious. It pays off so well when Marisica can just hand out this rock because she knows Cherry Pop's dumb enough to take it. This moment is so beautiful, because I've criticized, like, I do still worry that Marisica's macro plan is too fairy-ish. Like, all this convoluted stuff with the Carmine Beast and everything, it still feels very fairy, but, like, this is one of those few moments where, like, she does manage to shirk being a fairy, which is, like, what she's trying to do, and I love that. I especially love it because, like, the reason the Canneteer's plan is failing right now is everything they've done has been to counteract a fairy. Like, they're expecting to counteract Marisica the fairy, and so her just getting these little edges by not being that, like, it's what's made Toadsaw so powerful when he's escaped his label. Like escaping these boxes makes these others so much more powerful because, well, you can't just so easily counter them. But the cherry on top of this cake is that a huge helper for this plan, somebody who helped do this anti-fairy plan, was Rook. Like, Rook was far too fucking obsessed with Marisica's label as a fairy to consider that something like this might be on the table. Like, it's so good.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I guess the fact that they were so worried about her as a fae might have been what hampered their chances here.
Yeah, well, I think this idea of just, like, sitting on the outside and, you know, like, not being in the center is a little bit anti-fae, and it's a bit why it's worked for her. Like, it's why none of them really saw it coming. Like, they're expecting her to want to be involved, and she is. Like, she, yeah, that's why she stays to watch.
She has too much want to be involved, if anything.
But, like, she's fighting that urge just enough to, like, put this substitute in. Like, the reveals in these two chapters are all just so fucking good. This idea that, like, I just can't get past the fact that Rook helped them set everything up with the idea that it was going to be anti-fairy, because, like, this is sort of my criticism of the Oni. Like, their obsession with the labels has kind of just shifted them into being so anti-label that they've kind of just gotten back there the long way around. It's like, of course, Rook didn't really conceive, and she underestimated Toadsaw at points as well. Like, she doesn't quite conceive of people breaking their boxes in ways that are not as overt as hers, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. We jump back again, and we're with the plotters. We have Marisica, Charles, and Edith plotting what they will do, and Charles unfortunately seems to be having no say in the matter.
I mean, you say unfortunately, but, like, I think it's fortunately, because I'm still holding out for my man to be, like, an unwilling participant.
Well, yeah, which seems pretty likely based on how this goes. Marisica says something along the lines of, Charles, you can't do shit about it, so shut the fuck up.
I hope so. I've just always held out this hope that, you know, he's an unwilling participant, and
yeah,
I guess we'll see. This definitely, though, hard confirms he is a participant.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see if the Canneteers survive long enough to end up getting to talk to him. That'll be interesting.
Yeah, especially because he has no obligation to keep to his oaths, right? So Edith and Marcy have done? Sworn him to secrecy? Lol.
Yeah, well, I mean, you don't even really need to swear him to secrecy, though, because he could just lie. But I mean, he did say, I think, in Arc 5, when he was offering to, like, take away Clem's innocence properly, he sort of said, like, there's still a cost for him. Like, right. He won't notice it as much. I kind of get the impression it's sort of like taking on an extra $1,000 of debt when you're already $1 million in debt. Like,
yeah, I see.
Like, there's still negative consequences, but it's just he's already got so many, he won't really.
It probably won't make a difference, yeah.
Hell, maybe the Canneteers, I mean, depending on how this trial goes for them, the Canneteers might have a lot to talk about with him in a couple of chapters if they're struggling to deal with the fact they don't really have their powers anymore.
We'll have to see.
Like, that sort of worst case, maybe not quite being forsworn, but, like, essentially having all their rights taken away from them as Kennet's practitioners certainly feels like it's on the cards.
Yeah, definitely. Before we get to that, though, I want to pull out this other note, which is, as Marcy is kind of propositioning Edith and Charles, she says this line, "I wish to turn what seems to be a failure in the making into a resounding victory." which implies that at the very least, Edith and Charles were doing this before Marisica got involved, right? They're up to something. Or potentially there's another conspirator?
I definitely just read it as her joining later. In fact, I wouldn't even be surprised if this was after the creation of the Hungry Choir that she joined. I don't know where the other conspirator would come into it. Wait, what makes you think that?
Well, just that it seems weird to me that Edith and Charles are the only two people plotting something before Mariska was involved. Like, based on what we saw of Edith, it seemed like her whole reason for doing stuff was because she was promised things by Mariska, right? But this implies that Charles and Edith were doing something first, and it doesn't seem to me like they would have done that without someone else also calling some kind of shots.
Oh, God, yeah, I need to go back and reread some of the Edith stuff. I don't know. I could see Edith and Charles wanting to start something and letting it get a bit away from them, and then Mariska came in and fucking, you know, like drove the bus off a cliff.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but what would they have been up to then?
Maybe just, like, God, it could have started as on. I was gonna say it could have started as innocently as just building the Hungry Choir to keep Kennet safe. But I think we did learn when the Hungry Choir was interviewed in Arc 3 that killing the Carmine Beast was programmed into it from the start. So, yeah, God, maybe Charles is, like, an actual conspirator just because it still feels like there's a missing chunk of that motivation. And he slits into that spot so easily as somebody who has a very good MO for wanting to fuck over the Carmine Beast.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So yeah, coming back to the present, the Kenneteers are starting a trial against, in air quotes, Mariska, but it obviously seems doomed to fail, and real Mariska decides to leave with the contest in motion.
Yeah. They're so fucked. Like, this is so bad.
It's pretty rough.
Like, what a fucking cliffhanger. Imagine if Wabo just took a month off now. Like what a fucking train wreck.
Yeah. I mean, what could... Is there any way they can salvage this?
No, like, at the very least, they're going to lose a lot of karma and the Aurum's respect at this point. And there's a part that we didn't bring up, which is that the Aurum... Mariska says that she basically knows the Aurum knows what's going on, knows what she's pulling, but, like, because of the bullshit of the system, isn't really allowed to do anything about it. God, like, there's so many layers of fuck to this, and I can't see a way that this doesn't at least cost them a lot.
Yeah.
This is just, like, this trial, because so my understanding of the ending is we're starting with a trial of the Kenneteers, which, like, God, I can't wait to see where this goes. It's going to be insane.
Yeah, it's scary for sure.
Well, because especially, like, there's no way Mariska and her doppelganger have, like, the only thing I can think of that would happen in a trial of the Kenneteers and Liberty is this idea of, oh, I'm innocent and you attacked me without cause.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that that's the whole story when, like, you know, a fairy and a fairy are involved in this. Like, there's going to have to be some other bullshit that's going to pop out in this trial, and I have no idea what it is, but I can't wait.
Yeah, I'm nervous. so they're in trouble. Paul Pekkasnod almost saved the day, but was unable to do so. So, yeah, rough ending.
Keep going, little buddy. I have faith that you'll save the day later on.
You'll get there, Pekkasnod.
It's so heartbreaking seeing that poor little guy run up and start banging on the mirror. Sorry, not the mirror, the, like, edge of the arena. Mm. And Verona's instantly like, what's wrong, little buddy? And it's like, oh, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
I hate it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the end of these chapters, I suppose. No extra material this week.
Yeah. And, like, that's got to be the end of the arc, right? Like, 11.Z ending like that. Like, it's just, we're about to head into an insane arc 12.
Mm. Yeah. But let's dive into some Pale predictions, shall we? Predictions left by our community in the Pale Predictor sheet form that we have linked in the show notes down below. Do you have a prediction that you liked from the community that you want to pull out?
Yeah, I have one that I think is going to almost certainly be true. And this comes to us from Belig Tal, who says that Toadswallow's Goblin Market is going to be extremely successful, but not for the reason he expects. The main draw and the source of the vast majority of the sales of the Goblin Market are going to be merchandise inspired by the local Goblin Sage.
Yeah, okay, I can see it. I mean, I know I would buy Snowdrop merchandise.
So. Exactly, that's the thing. It's just all going to be Snowdrop merchandise. Look it up. I bet you Wabo's already bought the domain, like 8thcourt.com.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to sell Snowdrop merchandise from there. You just wait.
yeah. So I put out a prediction.
Have you pulled out a series?
Yeah, I've put out a prediction. I think there are some things to it that are serious, but it's also a little bit of a meme prediction. Anyway, from Ace of Sword, Cherry Pop is going to get swole. She took the Sisyphus curse, which can be overcome through willpower and doesn't inflict lethal wounds. Cherry Pop is just too stupid to quit. And as far as goblins are concerned, anything less than lethal is something they can recover from. So Cherry Pop is effectively just going to keep going through sheer force of will until she overcomes this Sisyphean curse and is a big, beefy goblin. And this is how Cherry Pop is going to become the most powerful goblin in Kennet, and I'm very keen to see.
I guess to get a bit nitpicky with it, the whole thing where goblins get like physical injuries that they can recover from, I feel like that wouldn't apply to the Sisyphean stone curse.
Mm.
Because I almost feel like that's not like this. I feel like the physical like injury recovery part of goblins is like more just because that's like the pattern that's been established. Like they hurt each other, so the hurt just doesn't matter. Mm. Whereas like this feels like a more metaphysical injury that might be more serious for a goblin. But I really like the read that Cherry Pop is too stupidly stubborn to really quit, and that means she can overcome this like curse.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know. I could see it going the other way though. Like it's Cherry Pop, so. Like, are we just going to find her lying on the ground, not really able to do anything, like, a couple of minutes later because she just can't be stuffed? It could go either way. It's such a fun idea, though. I hadn't thought to consider where the fuck Cherry Pop is going to go with this curse.
Yeah, who knows? What
happened to a nicer girl?
Yeah, I just... Maybe you're right, and maybe I'm being a bit too optimistic, but I just think it's... it would be hilarious for this to be something that makes Cherry Pop super powerful, as well as still stupid.
I think what, like, I don't know if it'll make her super powerful, but I like the idea that it's just nobody's ever going to notice she has the curse because it just sort of barely slows her down.
Mm.
Like, she's just so single-minded and, like, small anyway that it just doesn't really get its teeth into her like it would someone like Marisica.
Mm.
And so it's going to be this thing where, like, everyone else will realize, like, a year later that Cherry Pop's been cursed this whole time.
Mm.
And it just didn't really slow her down.
Yeah, yeah. Cherry Pop, what a wonderful character. so if you have your own pale predictions that you want to leave in our pale predictor sheet, you can find the link in the show notes down below. But before we wrap the show, Elliot, we've got some discussion question answers to revisit.
That's right. It's been 2 weeks since we asked everyone. Now that we've seen both Nettie and KT, what do you think one of the offspring of your city spirit would be like? And yeah. I have to say, not many people who answered this question read that part about the one offspring, because we got a lot of very good and very thorough answers.
True, yes. I found this is a really interesting discussion question. I think often, obviously, we always advise people to go and read these answers rather than just our kind of summaries of them, but especially for this one, because I feel like the joy of the answers to this question is kind of getting these pictures of people's towns or cities. Like, this is a very interesting lens through which to learn about a city or town that you don't know about. And we'll kind of talk about some of them a bit, but a lot of them are, you really will get the most out of if you just go and read them yourselves because they're really fun.
Well, yeah. And especially the nature of our discussion question answers in this podcast is we have to just obliterate the detail out of them. And that's what, like, more so than most discussion questions, those details really matter to the answers for this one.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about the details, effectively, the finer kind of nuances that characterize these cities and towns. I think it's also interesting that I think a lot of people focused on like the negative or stressful parts of their cities or towns. And I mean, that's, I get the impulse because that's probably what I would focus on a lot as well. But like, I didn't see a lot of answers that had very positive characteristics. And I wonder if there's an element to this of like, a divide between rural and urban places to live, where like more rural or smaller towns feel more run down, like more full of character, but also obviously have a lot more overt problems, whereas cities maybe have less overt problems but also have less of that character. Still some, but it's kind of like the edges are dulled on it, I suppose.
Well, and it's harder to capture the vibe of like a big city. Like we'll get to one answer that that talks about Sydney.
Yes.
But that answer definitely ran into the problem where, like, Sydney is so big, so sprawling, like the concept of thinking of it as one entity doesn't actually quite hold up if you're there.
Yeah, which means...
So that's probably the other side of it.
Yeah, and that answer had to lose some detail, right? Because, you know, we've got, to give a brief geographical overview of Sydney, you know, there's, like, the West, which is... an area of Sydney, but then, you know, within there, there's obviously sub communities and sub locales and stuff. I live in the Inner West, which I absolutely love as a place, which is very like a progressive-y area. But then the West of Sydney as a conglomerate doesn't necessarily represent that. So I think there's a lot of like the cities have to have those blunted edges or like more generalizations made just because that's kind of what it's like when you live with a huge, huge amount of people that have diverse experiences of how they live their lives. Hard to represent them in just 3 to 4 representative, you know, people, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And also to your point on like things being much more negative, I think you're probably right. I think that's just how people think. Like, I don't know. My answer for my town would absolutely be negative. But that probably is unfair because there are really nice aspects to where I live. It's just like, it's just human nature to focus on the parts that annoy you. Like, and like grass is always greener.
Yeah. So should we talk about some of the answers? I mean, I feel like we're just going to give a very overview-y kind of look at them, but I do think that they're worth shouting out because they were so interesting. Beard of Valor was one that I really liked, talking about Clarksburg in West Virginia. And just like, it was such an interesting way to examine the lens of Beard of Valor's experiences moving into the town and living in the town and having these characters that felt like they had the soul of this town in them. I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah. Like West Virginia is sort of a place I'm a little bit familiar with only because of McElroy content.
And well, so like... and I've played Fallout 76, so I know what's up.
Okay. I have not played that.
Elliot, it's almost heaven, West Virginia, okay? Blue Ridge Mountains, something river, all right?
that's true. I understand a bit of the geography. No, but like Beard of Valor started to touch on like West Virginia's history with kind of being exploited for its natural resources, like both the people and the nature there. And like stuff I was vaguely familiar with, and it's super interesting sort of seeing somebody who lives there take that and just turn it into like these representations of both the state as well as this town specifically. I wanted to pull out a really interesting one we got from Flower Priest, who lives in this like they use the term frontier zone, which I sort of had to Google, but it's essentially like they live in like a city or two cities that are both on the border between Paraguay and Brazil.
Mm.
So it's like a city that's kind of divided between two countries. And so that Flower Priest sort of set up this duality between the embodiment of the Paraguayan side and the embodiment of the Brazilian aspects of the town. So that like there was this partnership between Pedro and Ponta, who are like kind of inseparable and complete one another, but at the same time are sort of always a little bit at war and condescending of one another because of the cultural differences. And it was a super interesting answer that paints this real, like the writing was really good, paints this great picture of this town kind of caught between two countries and two cultures.
Mm. Yeah. It's, Yeah, I found this a very interesting one as well. And like, fuck, what an interesting way to examine the kind of social political environment of a place like this that has such a rich history through this lens. I just thought it was very fascinating to read.
Yeah, and the idea of the partnership of the two aspects who are, both inseparable and cannot stand each other.
Yes, like, I love that.
That sort of duality is perfect for storytelling, and like it just it enticed me in just this Reddit comment. Like,
yeah, definitely. I loved, of course, from Vice Versailles, who talked about Sydney that we already kind of mentioned.
yes.
Just because I recognized it and I was like, oh shit, this is great. It's so much fun to read about. Especially loved Miss Sydney North, who is a representation of North Sydney, which is the kind of very white affluent area of Sydney, I suppose.
I want to pull out this one quote because it's just so good. Yeah. Vice Versailles wrote this very well as well. And this part goes, Miss Sydney North is a prim and proper businesswoman who spends an impressive amount of time on yachts, tasting wine, and posting to go photo yourself her carefully curated depiction of a perfect life, complete with live, laugh, love motivational posters and political views that only function because she has enough money to have them.
What a great line that ending is. Political views that only function because she has enough money to have them is such a beautifully brutal takedown.
And it's so, like, for those of you who know Sydney, fuck, I've never heard a more concise but perfect rip on North Sydney. Like, that is spot on.
Yeah.
All the people I know from North Sydney, Miss Sydney North represents them perfectly.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a wonderful answer.
God, there were so many others. It was funny, Vice Versailles definitely felt like they were picking... answering this question on hard mode, because obviously both of us have, like, you do live in Sydney and I have lived in Sydney, so there was a much more fine tooth comb in my interpretation of this answer than any of the others. I really liked Victoria Sydney, like the CBD in the suburbs,
named after the QVB, which is wonderful.
I loved the quote, Victoria is a tired, overly qualified middle management type trying to make ends meet in a hostile property market. Their fits of short-temperedness and stubbornness are born of anxiety, with a bad case of imposter syndrome born from not quite living up to the national anthem. Like, fuck, brilliantly written, perfect explanation of central Sydney. Like, so good.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's just because we have it certainly is because we have experience with it, but I just feel like Australia and the concept of like Australiana and this almost hypocritical kind of duality of, like, you know, we believe in our version of the American dream, I guess you would call it the Australian dream, but also a severe undercurrent of like hypocritical to that idea, racism. I just think Australia and Sydney as an example of that. It's a very interesting place to dive into practitioner-wise, like the symbology of that. You know, Vice Versailles goes into like Anzac statues and memorials around Sydney and the kind of embodiment of that spirit and what that might look like. And I just think, man, that would be so fucking interesting.
The answer also touches on, like, I think it was in the Victor section, talks about, like, you know, places like Redfern and the scars of the white Australia policy that still exist, particularly in Sydney. This is such a good answer, and it was on a place that we both have experience with.
I just want to talk about it forever. And the problem is, like, this one obviously appeals to us because we know it and are familiar with that kind of cultural context. But I'm sure each of these has that. It's just, like, we can only barely scratch the surface. So, yeah, definitely go and read these discussion question responses, I suppose.
Yeah, a quick shout out to Sengachi as well. Mm. It was another university town. I feel like so many of the answers to this revolved around university towns.
Yeah,
I guess because they've got such distinct, different flavors. Like, living in one myself, it's absolutely the difference between when uni is on and when it isn't is huge.
Mm. Yeah, seasonal cycles of that, and I think it came up in another one. Oh, which one was it? There was another one that talked that was like in a.
Tisawat did Oxford. Is that the one you're thinking
of? I can't remember. But, like, seasonal, the vibes of towns that have such strong seasonal presences, like Kennan, I suppose, I think is also very interesting.
Well, so Singachi like went on. So they were talking about Tucson, Arizona, and they didn't just mention that it was a university town, but they talked about like it's also a place full of retirement communities, apparently. And the other big one was there are lots of like affluent people who have winter houses there.
Oh yes, that's right. This was the one I was thinking of.
And so like there's a whole population that, you know, I guess in a way similar to Kennett. There's a population that just comes for the winter. Although unlike Kennett, they're not tourists or anything. This is just rich people who can afford a second life, I guess. It was really interesting getting this idea of Tucson as a place that's like one quarter university, one quarter retirement communities, one quarter rich people who only live there half the year, and then one quarter permanent residents who are really suffering and get the worst raw deal.
Yeah.
It is such an interesting device for people to explore what makes their town their town.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I loved it. Well, thanks everyone for leaving your discussion responses.
Yes.
Definitely go out and read them if you haven't. But we have a new discussion question as well. And I think this was an interesting one because we've obviously, you know, both in this show and in Deep Impact, our previous show, talked about things like what would your implement be? What would your animal mask be? All this stuff. But I think an interesting question to ask and to consider is, if you were going to subvert yourself like our Kenneteers have done, how would your answers to these questions change? For example, what practice would you lean into? What animal would your mask be? Not naturally, but as a subversion of yourself. What would your alternate path be?
And I think like the key to this for me is like what the Kenneteers have done or what Wildbo's done is it's not like the opposite. Like Verona didn't get a dog mask because she's not a cat now. I don't think this question is, we're not asking what is the opposite of what you would be. It's what is a path you could have walked, but you didn't.
Yeah.
With the animal masks, like Verona in her past was a snake. Like, you know, that is something she's trying to get better about, but she's leaning into these sides of herself that she tried to leave behind. And I guess like, what would that look like for you?
Almost leaning into the parts of yourself that you may have noticed but consciously avoided as well. You know, Avery as the wolf is another great example of this, of like something that she actually kind of is a bit fearful of about herself.
What is a path you deliberately chose not to take?
I think that'll be a very interesting discussion question, so I look forward to everyone's answers. You can leave your answers to that discussion question in the discussion thread, which will be linked again in the show notes down below.
Yes. Don't forget, we are on Twitter. That's where you can see, you know, announcements about the episode, great tweets from Wildbo's family.
Yep. That was so good. Oh, my God. If you haven't seen that, definitely go to our Twitter and check it out because it's wonderful.
Yeah. Wildbo's brother tweeted just the cutest thing ever.
Yeah.
So check it out.
Yes. While you're on the socials, why not check out the Doof Media website, doofmedia.com, where you can see all of the other great shows on the Doof Media Network, including a new contest that is being run, Do the King Thing, a crossover between Do the Right Thing and Kingslingers, writing Stephen King-inspired horror short stories.
Yeah, I like, obviously, those of you who have been following Kingslingers Season 2, which has sort of just started, they've been going through, like, you know, more of Stephen King's standalone or shorter stories.
Yeah, and still just Salem's Lot at the moment, but soon.
So that's what the season is going to be.
Yes.
And I guess they're thinking a lot more about what makes a Stephen King story a Stephen King story and what's so great about his premises. And so, yeah, they've teamed up with Alexandra and Jarvis to run, like, a cool write-your-own Stephen King-esque thing. I think they've already got a few entries, so it's like, go check it out if you want to do the right thing or if you love Stephen King. It should be a really fun competition.
Yeah. If you want to support the Doof Media Network and make sure we can keep doing things like these contests, the way to do that is to become a patron at patreon.com/doofmedia. Not only do you get the warm and fuzzies of helping support us to keep doing stuff, but you'll also get bonus things, bonus content, access to secret exclusive stuff.
Yeah, we just launched the penultimate episode of our current series of The High Ground.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we've ever publicly said what we're covering now, so I'll keep it a secret.
Ooh, but, I'm pretty sure we have, but okay. I mean, like, I was listening to the latest Deconstructing Directors on Pirates of the Caribbean 2, and they mentioned it. So oh, I'm pretty sure that the info is out there somewhere.
Well, we have just finished. We just did our episode on Pirates 4.
On Stranger Tides.
It was a movie.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting one to talk about.
Because we have a lot to say about it. Yeah.
There's so much to love and just so much to hate.
So much to bemoan, I guess.
Yes.
So
yeah, there's a public version of that feed, which I believe has just done episode 3 of Star Wars.
Yeah.
So it's rounding out the prequel trilogy. But if you want to be up to date and watch the movies along with us, join the Patreon and yeah, we'll join us for the final Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
So far. while you're on Patreon, why not make sure you stop by Wildbo's Patreon as well and support him at patreon.com/Wildbo. Make sure you keep throwing support his way because he needs it to keep coming up with all these horrifying twists and turns that keep us so hooked in this story.
And make sure you actually go to his Patreon and not some doppelgangers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear there's a secret Patreon that's pretending to be Wildbo's Patreon out there. You don't want to give it your money or you'll get forsworn.
Exactly. Cool. So with that, we'll see you all next week. Presumably for our Reflecting on Arc 11 episode.
Yeah, wow. Unless things go really wild.
What could possibly come after that was still an
Arc 11? The cherry pop interlude that we've all been waiting for.
I won't say no. See ya.
Bye.